From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. New Jersey Governor Jim McGreevy made headlines in August 2004 when he resigned from office declaring, "I am a gay American." He did not mention in his resignation speech that the man he had an affair with was the person he had appointed as Homeland Security Advisor. Now McGreevy's telling the story behind his resignation in the new memoir, The Confession. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with McGreevy and we'll discuss some of the things he's not talking about with two political reporters from the Newark Star-Ledger, Jeff Whalen and Josh Margolin. They were part of the team that won a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of McGreevy's resignation. Also, the controversy over the recent docudrama, The Path to 9/11, has linguist Jeff Nunberg thinking about what a docudrama is and isn't. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As you probably know, Jim McGreevy, the former governor of New Jersey, is talking about his formerly secret gay life. He's written a memoir called The Confession, and he's doing media interviews. We'll hear from him a little later. But first, we're going to talk with two political reporters from the Newark Star-Ledger, New Jersey's leading newspaper. Josh Margolin and Jeff Whalen were part of the team that won a Pulitzer Prize for the Star-Ledger's coverage of McGreevy's resignation. When McGreevy resigned on August 12, 2004, he revealed that he is gay and that although he is married, he'd had an affair with a man. He said, "Given the circumstances surrounding the affair, its likely impact on my family and my ability to govern, I've decided the right course of action is to resign." He did not mention that the man he now says he had an affair with, Golan Sapel, was an Israeli whom McGreevy helped bring to New Jersey, appointed to his staff, and gave the position of Homeland Security Advisor. I asked the two reporters about the questions surrounding McGreevy and Sapel's professional relationship. Jeff Whalen spoke first.
The key question was, I mean, and the reason why that this exploded so much, when we go back to the day of August 12th and when they were wrestling, McGreevy and his advisors, with should he resign, should he not resign, there was one of his advisors who, you know, as they were weighing the political calculations, can you survive this? They said, you know, a gay affair, okay, that's, or you had an affair, that's a tough thing to get over, but they said you can survive it. A gay affair, you know, is going to make it more sensational, tougher politically to manage it, but you can survive it in a state like New Jersey. And then they said, you know, you appointed your lover as the Homeland Security Advisor a few months after 9/11, and it turns out the guy didn't have credentials. That was it. Game over. He could not survive it politically. And that was the key thing. Josh had done a story very early on after Golan was appointed that as an Israeli citizen, he could not even get FBI clearance. So in New Jersey, which was so close to the World Trade Center attacks, you had this heightened awareness about the dangers of terrorism. And to make that appointment was a fantastic example of bad judgment, to say the least, I think. And that was a key factor in all this.
Now, I'm correct in saying, right, that in his resignation speech, McGreevy didn't mention that the person he had the affair with had been in his administration.
That is correct.
Right.
What were the calculations behind that?
I think that speech will go down as a brilliant piece of political public relations mastery. I think that they were trying to wrestle the story away from McGreevy and the headline and the leads of stories in the news, the snippet on the 6 o'clock news, being McGreevy hired his lover as the Homeland Security Advisor, and that's why he was stepping down. And they brilliantly, you know, that line, the "I am a gay American," made that the headline in our paper. That was the large point headline the next day. And by downplaying the Golan Sapel thing and making that something that wound up in the third or fourth paragraph about having to explain, you know, who this figure was, the real thing that grabbed people was his coming out and his wrestling with his homosexuality and finally being honest about that. And it put the Golan Sapel piece, I think, a little further down into a story of when you're explaining that. And to this day, you get outside of the New Jersey area, if I go out to the Midwest or wherever, people still say, well, you know, I don't understand why he had to resign just because he was gay. And I think that goes to the fact that, you know, they did an excellent job of framing this story about as a coming out story and as someone who had betrayed his wife, but it being a very personal matter rather than something that directly related to his judgment as a public official.
And then also, it's important to go back to that time, because now we and McGreevy and everybody else involved is a lot freer to talk about it. But remember the timing of what was going on in August of 2004. The reason this came to a head was because Sapel had been threatening a lawsuit and the statute of limitations was running out. At that point, and I don't know what's in Jim McGreevy's mind because I have yet to ask him a single question that he's willing to answer about this, but there may well have been a legal calculation that he did not want to confirm an affair with this man who was threatening a lawsuit at that point because it may have opened him up to an exposure that no longer exists because the statute of limitations ran out shortly after the August 12th, and it was up to Golan Cepel himself and his lawyers to go public with the first statement that I am Golan Cepel, I am the one he's referring to who he had an affair with, or whatever the wording was.
What are some of the things that you think were inappropriate in the professional relationship between Governor McGreevy and his aide, Golan Cepel? Things in terms of how he brought him here to the United States, the positions he appointed him to, the qualifications he had for those positions.
It's not so much what we think is as much as what people were questioning. And McGreevy actually delves into this quite significantly in the book. He pretty much didn't have any qualifications to be special counselor to the governor for Homeland Security. He didn't have the qualifications for it before 9/11, certainly not after 9/11. And it doesn't seem that anybody even quarrels with that any longer. The whole thing took on a life of its own because as soon as Cepel's identity and position got into the public domain, questions started being raised by very significant political players, people close to McGreevy, people not close to McGreevy. They were going public. They were asking questions. Please explain this man's qualifications. McGreevy reacted, you know, the way that the DePauls and the operatives always talk about. He got into the bunker. He wouldn't answer a question. We referred to him throwing up a protective wall around Cepel. They wouldn't allow him to go to the state senate. It became a huge sort of burning issue in Trenton. So there was never any question. Golan never had qualifications for that job. There's a little bit in the book where McGreevy tries to explain that that was only one portfolio he had, but he was introduced to the world through that portfolio, and that basically defined the issue all the way through.
And it didn't stop with his resignation from state government, with Golan Cepel's resignation from state government. Directly after that resignation, the governor helped him land a job with a prominent politically connected lobbying firm in Trenton. And that raises questions as well. You know, you have the governor helping what he says is his boyfriend get a job with a lobbying firm. It raises questions about indebtedness the administration has to a favor, you know, that a lobbying firm is helping them get. And he proceeded to help him get other jobs with entities that had business before state government and needed things from state government, and that raises ethical questions, some of which I don't think he addresses very extensively in the book. I think there's a cursory talk about that, but he doesn't grapple with those questions and what they meant for him.
Meanwhile, Golan Cepel is saying that he and McGreevy never had an affair, that it was actually sexual harassment, that Cepel was sexually harassed by McGreevy. And I'm wondering how serious you take what Cepel is saying now.
I take it very seriously. We're at exactly the same point with what McGreevy and Cepel say today as we were with the rumors about McGreevy's sexuality going back. We're in the very messiest of places to be, both in terms of human behavior and in terms of covering people and covering politicians. You have a situation where there was some sort of activity that went on behind closed doors between two people, and those two people have differing recollections or tales to tell from those encounters. And neither one has proven his case. Neither one has gone into any kind of situation where they're compelled by law to tell the truth, and so who do you believe?
You question the ethics of appointing Golan Cepel to the McGreevy administration. Were there other people in the administration whose qualifications were questioned, or other controversies similar to this, but not revolving around homosexuality, in the administration?
There definitely were. There were a lot of appointments that McGreevy had made that had come under scrutiny and been viewed as just either bad appointments or politically tainted appointments. He mentions one in the book, which was a man by the name of Charles Kushner, who was a major developer who he appointed to the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. Kushner had contributed over $1 million to his campaigns, and there was a lot of criticism from Republicans and others that this had been some sort of payback. McGreevy defends that appointment in the book very aggressively. Kushner wound up eventually being caught up in an investigation about donations he had made to Democrats, including McGreevy, and then got caught up in a bizarre, which there's a lot of, McGreevy himself said in the book that it's amazing the number of people around him who had crazy meltdowns. Charlie Kushner was one of them. He was convicted in a bizarre scheme that stemmed from this investigation, where he had videotaped or had his brother-in-law videotaped having sex with a hooker, and he used that to blackmail him, and eventually went down. And that happened in the weeks before McGreevy's resignation announcement. But that's one example. There were other examples. The thing about the Sapel one is it seemed, in addition, if you take away the homosexuality aspect out of it, and which at that point was speculation for most of the time, I mean, for the entire time until McGreevy made his announcement. But what took that into a different realm, I think, was the Homeland Security piece of it, where it didn't seem like routine, mundane political patronage appointments to various things. It seemed something that resonated with the public, I think, and grabbed their attention a little more, because it was an issue where people were not willing to tolerate favoritism or cronyism or patronage. And then you had in the other aspect of it, which was this backdrop of suspicion about their relationship, and that is what brought it to the fore even more so.
And then even beyond that, you ended up having a situation where, when we started doing research into what Sapel was actually doing, it turned out that he was basically doing nothing. I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say it's a no-show job, because that's a characterization I'm uncomfortable making, but we ended up filing a Freedom of Information request to get all of his work product. And there was pretty minimal product to be had for $110,000 a year for somebody who was a Homeland Security advisor.
My guests are Josh Margolin and Jeff Whalen, political reporters for the Newark Star-Ledger. We'll talk more about covering Jim McGreevy after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Josh Margolin and Jeff Whalen, political reporters for the Newark Star-Ledger. They were part of the team that won a Pulitzer Prize for coverage of New Jersey Governor Jim McGreevy's resignation. Would you describe what it was like in your newsroom after McGreevy made his resignation speech? You guys won a Pulitzer Prize for your coverage of his resignation and its aftermath. So what was it like right after that speech was finished?
Let me take you back a little bit to before the speech.
But we do want to say that neither one of us was actually in the newsroom at the time, because we were both out on the street trying to report the story. So we only have heard secondhand what it was like.
Good point.
But for that day, Josh and I both take the Jersey Turnpike down to work down to Trenton in the morning. And leading up to this day, I mentioned Charlie Kushner, one of his biggest campaign contributor, involved in this bizarre blackmail scheme, intimidating an FBI witness. You had his other biggest fundraiser, or one of his biggest fundraisers, a man by the name of David Damiano, a trash hauler, who had been indicted. And McGreevy was involved in that because he had uttered the word Machiavelli, which federal prosecutor said was a code word for a bribery scheme. So the governor himself never charged, but was somehow involved in that. So you had all these really bizarre political plot twists running out there. And as we're driving down to work that day, and his commerce secretary also had resigned under an ethics investigation a few days before, Josh calls me up as we're writing down. He said, have you heard anything weird in the last 24 hours?
Last 12 hours.
And I thought to myself, well, you know, my standards for what is weird in this state have you know, really taken a turn. So I said, no. And Josh had heard the first tip about what was going to happen that day. And for some reason, and we'd heard these rumors for years, for some reason, this felt real immediately. And it felt possible. And we immediately put some calls out and started to realize that this was going to happen that afternoon. Although right up until that moment, and I was in the governor's office when he made his announcement, but we had a pretty good idea. I mean, we were 95% sure of what he was going to say when he made that announcement, and it still took my breath away, and I think took everyone in the governor's office breath away when he actually said that. And as Josh said, we were not in the newsroom, but everyone was gathered around the TV.
Apparently it was dead silence. Everyone was gathered around the various TVs around the newsroom, and then he said the words, "My truth is I'm a gay American," and apparently one reporter who wrote one of the stories that was also part of the Pulitzer Prize winning package, she went sort of like, oh my God, or some sort of gasp, but it was so loud and the room was so quiet that everybody across the whole newsroom heard, and it was a pretty dramatic moment from the way people described it to us, although we actually didn't have much of a chance to process anything until maybe midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, 8-9 hours after the announcement, because it was just that kind of pace that day.
Before McGreevy came out, you both had decided not to pursue rumors that McGreevy was gay. But after he came out and made his resignation address and being gay was kind of on the table, how did you draw the line at that point between what was public and what was private? What was just kind of like personal stuff that you didn't need to investigate? And what was really relevant that the public should know?
In all honesty, after he made his announcement, in terms of our reporting and questions that we would ask, there was nothing that was off limits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not to say that everything that we learned or suspected or somebody suggested to us would wind up in the paper. But we embarked on a 3-month investigation to find out everything we could, good, bad, and different, that led up to that moment when he resigned and the ultimate end of his career. And that's when we came upon the information about the strip clubs and the go-go bars and the visits to the gay clubs in Atlantic City and other kinds of information, because at that point there was no longer the response that you typically would have to a newspaper where people would say, no, you have no right to ask that question. The gloves were off, literally.
Not to mention, I mean, his sex life seemed to be so wound up in his political career. That's what was amazing about it. There's the anecdote that he tells about the prostitute who had claimed that she had sex with him back in 1997. That's one of the things that we uncovered in this investigation Josh is talking about. And in the story there was he says that it never happened. It was a lie. He never even met her. But his political handlers did take it seriously enough as he was running for governor that they took this prostitute and they ferried her down to Florida to hide her out and keep her away from newspaper reporters before the campaign. So that's the other factor here, is that his sex life was completely intertwined with his political career. So those questions had to be asked.
Let me quote something that McGreevy writes in the acknowledgments of his book. He says, for chronicling my political life so closely and not always with rancor, I'd like to thank members of the New Jersey Press Corps whose work I consulted in creating this account. And he includes your names in that list of members of the New Jersey Press Corps that he wants to thank. So did it please you to know that he was rereading your articles about him to write this book?
You know, reading the book, actually, there was a lot that was familiar in there, I'll say that. I was actually surprised by that line. I mean, he did have a very troubled relationship with most of the press corps, and I think that stems from what he acknowledges himself was the secrecy that drove him. And because he had the larger secret that he was trying to keep about his alleged affair with Golan and his homosexuality, that informed every decision that he made, everything became a major secret. You could not ask his administration, you know, you couldn't get them to confirm that the sky was blue. Everything was a major investigation. And that affected the relationship with him. And I think he did feel beat up a lot by the press. So I was surprised that he did acknowledge not just us, but other members of the press corps. I think maybe looking back now, he feels that a lot of the scrutiny, he looks at a little differently.
Yeah, it's, you know, not having had his experiences, I guess in one way we can sort of understand it. I mean, what is the biggest hazard to somebody who was living his double life and had his secret at the time? It was an investigative reporter with a pad and a pen and license to ask questions. So you can understand that. And it certainly was pleasant to get the acknowledgement in the book, and we've actually had occasion to run into him since then, and people close to him, and he's remarked about how he bears no ill will toward us and some other reporters because he felt that we were largely just doing our jobs. And in all honesty, it was a very hard job to do for the time that he was governor. So, I guess it feels good, better than him criticizing us right now.
Well, I want to thank you both for talking with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Josh Margolin and Jeff Whalen are political reporters for the Newark Star-Ledger. They were part of the team that won a Pulitzer Prize for coverage of Governor McGreevy's resignation. We'll talk with Jim McGreevy in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Puccini's Ghost, a novel of psychological suspense by Morag Yass, author of Half-Broken Things. From the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, working to make cancer a national priority at Celebration on the Hill. Details at acscan.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, former New Jersey Governor Jim McGreevy tells his story, and what makes a docudrama different from other movies that borrow from historical sources. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has some thoughts on the genre. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After I spoke with political reporters Jeff Whalen and Josh Margolin about covering New Jersey Governor Jim McGreevy and his resignation, I spoke with McGreevy. He resigned and came out in his speech of August 12, 2004. McGreevy has written about his formerly secret gay life in his new memoir, The Confession. And he writes about Golan Sapel, the man McGreevy says he had an affair with while serving as governor. McGreevy had appointed Sapel Homeland Security Advisor. Jim McGreevy, welcome to Fresh Air. Your new book tells about your relationship with Golan Sapel, but you didn't mention him in your resignation. And the resignation, you said, given the circumstances surrounding the affair and its likely impact upon my family and my ability to govern, I've decided the right course of action is to resign. Maybe at the risk of asking the obvious, how come you didn't mention him and your relationship with him when you resigned?
Well, at the time, Terry, we were facing the prospect of a potential civil litigation, and that was the advice of counsel. But why I resigned is that I needed to take ownership of my bad judgment, my failed decisions, and also the prospect of trying to manage the state of New Jersey as governor and continue to be involved in the prospect of civil litigation would have just been untenable.
Were you blackmailed by him?
As I saw it, yes. Yes. I mean, his attorney asked for, as I describe in the book, for $50 million, and that number came significantly down. But yeah, it was a request for dollars. And obviously, I was intent upon hiding a secret that I had held with me the entirety of my life, namely that I was gay, and I had entered into this ridiculous relationship by virtue of my own error in judgment. But that was a truth, that was a reality that I didn't want to be exposed.
Do you think that had it not been for the fact that you had this relationship with somebody who you'd given a job to, a Homeland Security job, no less, that if it wasn't for that relationship, if you had come out and said, I am a gay American, do you think you would have had to resign?
No. If I had done it, quote unquote, right, if I had sort of come to terms with myself, sort of addressed my wife in a generous spirit and sought her understanding. You know, the citizens of the state of New Jersey, Terry, when I came out, were incredibly kind and overwhelmingly positive, not in terms of the imbroglio or the incident, but in sort of affirming me as a human being. But the sad reality is, but for Golan, I think I still would have been in the closet. I would not have been able to muster the courage to deal with that essential truth. And ironically, Golan became a blessing, which coerced me, which required me to set forth on a major life correction.
The person who you now describe as having been a blessing is now saying that you're a liar, that you never had an affair with him, you never had a sexual relationship with him. What's your reaction to what he's saying now?
Well, again, the book is painfully true. I've set forth my reality, and the purpose of the book, Terry, is to talk about the dangers of leading a double life, the dangers of leading a divided life, and for me, a closeted life. So what I've said is entirely true. Golan's remarks are his. They're false. But the purpose of the book is to talk about my reality, and is not to be condemnatory of anyone else, but to move forward on this journey, to take responsibility for my actions, and to move forward, and hopefully to share this narration and to start a clean slate.
You met Golan Sapel in Israel and brought him over to New Jersey and then made him your Homeland Security advisor. Now, you say in your book that you fantasized about him from the moment that you locked eyes on him. Did you bring him here because you had, you know, these feelings for him? And did you appoint him to your staff because of the feelings that you had for him?
I think, Terry, it was more of a progression. I mean, when I met Golan Sapel for the first time, I mean, there was an immediate attraction, both physically, intellectually, if you will, psychologically. I brought him over actually to work on the campaign and to work with the various Jewish organizations throughout the state of New Jersey. And New Jersey is the most wonderfully diverse state in the nation, but, you know, I was dealing with Orthodox communities, Reformed, conservative, secular communities. And Golan, as an Israeli, I mean, he had a unique skill set. He was bright. And I brought him over to work on the campaign. And then, you know, subsequently, a relationship developed.
And then you made him your Homeland Security advisor. And a lot of people have wondered, of all the positions to appoint him to, given how covert your relationship had to be, why make him Homeland Security advisor, particularly since as an Israeli, he wouldn't even have security clearance in the United States. He wasn't a citizen.
Sure. If I could just clarify, I mean, putting Golan Sapel on the payroll was a humongous exercise in bad judgment. But I just want to also clarify, I mean, he was not Homeland Security czar. That responsibility belongs to the Attorney General in the state of New Jersey and something called the Domestic Security Preparedness Task Force, of which Golan was not a member. He was on the governor's staff. He advised me on Homeland Security and other issues. And it was just an incredible lapse in bad judgment. And I ought not have done it. And if I could redo it, I would have.
Now, you write in your book, The Confession, that even though you made up your mind to behave in public as though you were straight, you carried on sexually with men, scores of men, in seedy bookstores, public parks. Can you talk a little bit about why? I mean, do you think that the scores of men and the seedy bookstores and public parks, did that have to do with being closeted? I mean, do you think if you weren't closeted that you would have had, that you wouldn't have that, wouldn't have had those kinds of relationships?
Yeah, I think, you know, being open and accepting oneself and in an honest, committed relationship, I mean, the bright light of day changes all of that. And the irony is what was public in terms of, you know, perceptions of my wife and my heterosexuality was grossly inauthentic. And what was authentic was the fact that I was gay. But because I thought that I couldn't celebrate and accept my sexuality in the bright light of day, it was something relegated to shadows and to dark alleys. And it became such a corrosive, shameful place. And, you know, if there's a larger message in the book besides me attempting to, you know, set the record straight and establishing a new baseline of truthfulness in my own life, it's also sort of sharing how, you know, the closet and how my inability to be open results in corrosive acting out, which was, for me, unhealthy, ungodly, and destructive.
Let me ask you, in terms of remaining closeted, how much of it do you think was coming out would be really bad for my career, I couldn't really function in American politics, and how much of it was that you just didn't, you were brought up in such a way to think, like, this isn't good, it's shameful to be gay, I can't be gay, therefore I will remain closeted. So in other words, how much of it was just, like, kind of political, and how much of it was more personal?
I think some of the positions that I took were political. I was against gay marriage. I mean, we moved forward on a domestic partnership, which was a great thing in the state of New Jersey. I think we were the third state in the nation to do so. But from political positions, I think some of that was political because, I didn't want to appear gay. I wanted to go after this you know, what I perceived to be this, you know, this middle stream. But I think what drove me personally was all the former. I mean, it were the impressions that I sort of garnered as a young person. It were, you know, the impressions that I had heard or that I had read as to the church's theology, as to the intellectual or the academic or thinking of the time. And those were deeply imprinted upon me. And also my actions, Terry, after that imprint only exacerbated that shame. I mean, because when people tell you that it's perverted and it's an abomination and you're acting out in anonymous trysts and that you know that it's not a committed, monogamous, healthy relationship, it just substantiates the premise upon which you accept that shame. And it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I think at its core, I viewed it as something terribly unhealthy and damnable.
You describe in your book having gone to what you describe as go-go bars, strip clubs. And this was a period in which there were rumors circulating that you were gay. And were you hoping to be recognized or not be recognized? Like, you describe this as kind of part of the play, you know, part of the theater of looking straight. But you were probably with colleagues who didn't want to be seen there, right? Because who in politics really wants to be seen at a strip club? So what went through your mind?
It was an interesting, you know, psychological perspective insofar as sort of I know early on, you know, who and what I am as a gay person. But then you almost have to create this image consciously in the minds of others as well as in your own mind so that you can flicker that perspective on the screen of being straight, of being heterosexual. And so I was intent, and now this was political as opposed to, you know, personal or sexual. I was intent on being, quote unquote, masculine machismo. And you know, this sort of sad, sick irony is, as opposed to reflecting, you know, the sort of the loving, balanced, healthy relationship of my parents who just celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary, you know, you run to stereotype. You run to, you know, that flagrant philanderer. And so that's what I wanted the boys to know. That's what I wanted the political culture to know, that I was as masculine, I was as irresponsibly heterosexual as, ironically, I was secretly in terms of my gay life.
So what was it like to be in strip clubs with, you know, women dancing on the poles or whatever they were doing when you were really, really gay and not interested in this at all?
Terry, it was just, it was just so ridiculous. I mean, I had no basic interest in what was happening, and it's all a facade. It was all pretend. It was acting in the worst way, and it was, and again, what was so disingenuous about it was not only did I not have an interest there, and I had to feign an interest so that my colleagues would see that I was sort of robust and quote unquote red-blooded American, but it became corrosive to me that the more you act distinct from who you are, it just divides, you know, the moral quality of that, you know, of my identity.
My guest is former New Jersey Governor Jim McGreevy. His new book about his formerly secret gay life is called The Confession. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jim McGreevy. He resigned as governor of New Jersey and came out in August 2004. His new memoir is called The Confession. One of the things you write about in the book that's gotten a lot of attention is that the night you first had an intimate physical relationship with Golan Sapel was a night when your wife was in the hospital recovering from a cesarean section. Your baby had just been born. And people think that the timing of that was, you know, a lot of readers, I think, or think that the timing of that was just so so awful. Yeah.
Yeah. It was. It was unforgivable. But Terry, I just saw the need, you know, in the book to be rigorously truthful, to be honest, and not to cut myself any slack. And I fully, you know, take responsibility for I almost can't find words for the inhumanity or the lack of compassion in that action. And it's also a, you know, product of the divide itself. I mean, in a strange, warped way. I mean, I just was over here in terms of my sexuality, and then over here as a husband and father, and in two different places. And I think it speaks to what happens when somebody isn't integrated. You know, as my friend Curtis and I sort of narrate this in the book, that the root of the words for integrity and integrated, you know, have a common root, and that lack of integration, that lack of healthy spirituality, created this false division that allowed me to compartmentalize in a warped manner.
You know, it's awkward doing this interview in a way, because I feel like, on the one hand, it's not my job here to be sitting in judgment of you. On the other hand, just like being here and reacting to the book and what you're saying, I find myself going through what probably a lot of people are going through, which is trying to decide how much do we kind of forgive the ill judgment that you had as governor in appointing Golan Sapel to the positions that you did and in having that affair with him? How much do we forgive that because, hey, society is the way it is and that kind of, you know, forced you in the closet? And how much do you not get off the hook because you were in the closet? How much, like, closet or no closet, there's a level of accountability and responsibility as governor that there's just, you know, nothing gets you off the hook on that?
Well, I'm in the latter camp. I mean, I don't think I ought to get off the hook. I mean, being gay, there might have been bad images and reflections that I internalized, but that doesn't get you off the hook for bad judgment. But being that divided self denies me, and I should speak in the first person, denied me any sense of happiness. Because that if I wasn't going to be truthful, if I wasn't going to accept who and what I am, if I wasn't going to be totally honest, I couldn't be godly, as I said, with a small g, in the sense of being having a relationship that was based in goodness. I could never get to happiness. And so the purpose of the book is to show the narration from the truth to godliness with that small g to happiness, and to show how that was not only denied, but just the exact opposite happened in the bifurcated self. You know, the ego thinks that I could have managed it. Based in shame, my sexuality is relegated to dark shadows. I act out inappropriately, unethically, and the entirety of what I think I could falsely manage collapses. And the ultimate reward for me, and I have that quote from Seneca in the beginning of the book, is that I needed a radical correction. I would have continued down this godless, amoral path but for this collapse. And, you know, whether I was acting in a wrongful way, in an unspiritual way, outside the laws of God and man, or whatever caused this collapse, you know, in retrospect, it was grace, because it forced me to confront the painful reality of who I am.
Listening to you describe your experiences, it sounds like maybe you've been in therapy.
Yes. Yeah. And it's been healthy. I mean, I had an experience. I've done three things. I mean, I had the experience at a hospital called The Meadows in Arizona. I also participate in the 12-step program. I don't have a substance abuse addiction, but I think it's a wonderful spiritual journey in the sense of acknowledging one's dependence, acknowledging the importance of being truthful, sharing that truth with others. And I'm also blessed to work with a great doctor in the city of New York, Byron Karasu, who, if I can plug one book today, it would be his, The Art of Serenity. And he talks, and we talk, about the importance of that truthfulness, of that godliness, with a small g, and that effort to seek happiness.
When I listen to you talk, it's almost as if you're talking about somebody else, that you're looking at this story and describing the shape of the story, almost as if it was somebody else's story.
No, it's maybe that's how maybe that's just how I'm telling it now. But no, it's been personal. It's been very searing, and it's very much my story, as imperfect and as it is.
Well, Jim McGreevy, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Jim McGreevy is the former governor of New Jersey. His new memoir is called The Confession. Coming up, our linguist Jeff Nunberg considers docudramas and their relationship to fact and fiction. This is Fresh Air. How do you draw the line between dramatic license and historical accuracy? That was the essence of the controversy over the recent ABC docudrama The Path to 9/11, just as it was a few years ago with this CBS miniseries that put words in Ronald Reagan's mouth that he never uttered. As our linguist Jeff Nunberg points out, docudrama may be a new word, but it raises old questions about truth and fiction.
I have a friend who started his publishing career many years ago in the New Yorker's legendary fact-checking department. After about a year or so in the job, he told me at lunch that he'd just gotten a promotion. From now on, he'd be the fiction checker. Gee, I said, what exactly does a fiction checker do? Well, there are really two things, he said. On the one hand, if somebody writes a short story about a dentist in Cleveland called Diego Minsky, you have to make sure that there isn't actually a dentist in Cleveland by that name. And on the other hand, you want to make sure that nobody gets on a Fifth Avenue bus and goes uptown. That's how things are supposed to work in fiction. You make up the people, and you leave the rest of the world as it is. Or if real people do show up under their own names, it's only in cameo appearances, like Napoleon in War and Peace, or Pauly Shore in an Entourage episode. But things get more complicated and controversial when real people move to center stage in the narrative, particularly when they're depicted doing things that never happened, as they were in the 2003 docudrama about Ronald Reagan, or the recent ABC docudrama, The Path to 9/11. Docudramas make literary theorists of us all. In an editorial about the 9/11 miniseries, the New York Times laid down its view categorically. When attempting to recreate real events on screen, it said, you do not show real people doing things they never did. Meanwhile, defenders of the miniseries were mining literary history to demonstrate that that's exactly what writers have always done. The columnist Victor Davis Hanson argued that the script took no liberties that you couldn't find in the works of Bob Woodward, Michael Moore, or Herodotus. Dramatists have been blending fact and fiction since Aeschylus, and some people like to say it's just docudramas all the way back. True, the term didn't actually enter the language until the 1970s, along with other genre-bending portmanteau words like infotainment and advertorial. But that hasn't stopped some people from using docudrama retroactively to refer to Elizabethan political pamphlets or Shakespeare's histories. Indeed, if there really were nothing more to docudrama than rifling the headlines for dramatic subjects, then the word would apply to movies like Quiz Show, Ali, Malcolm X, or just about every picture Oliver Stone ever made, not to mention old biopics like The Pride of the Yankees and The Glenn Miller Story. Anything, that is, that might describe itself as based on a true story. But when most of us talk about docudramas, we're not thinking of movies like Schindler's List or Raging Bull, which borrow from historical sources to create their own dramatic worlds. It may be unlikely that J. Edgar Hoover actually ate melon from a pool boy's mouth, the way Oliver Stone has Bob Hoskins do in the movie Nixon. But in the end, these movies stand or fall as cinema, not depictions of history, which is why they can be compelling even to people who have no interest in the events they take as their points of departure. People went to see Raging Bull because of Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro, not because they wanted to find out what made Jake LaMotta tick. But the docudrama was invented as a way of recreating real events, as the Times puts it, and as such, it's completely parasitic on them. If you happen to be out of the country when the Elizabeth Smart kidnapping was all over the media, you're not going to be very interested in watching the made-for-TV movie based on it. Docudramas reshape the events we've been watching on TV according to the well-known rules of TV drama, where stories follow a seven-act trajectory before they're brought to a reassuring moral closure. The object is simply to give us the romantic side of familiar issues. So the docudrama is by definition a modest form, which avoids drawing any attention to itself as art. The camera angles and lighting are conventional, the scripts are efficient and melodramatic, the psychology is simplified to stereotypes that drive the plot, and public figures are played by second-tier actors who are unlikely to leave any strong impressions behind them. Above all, docudramas are eminently forgettable, not just because their believability requires them to be pedestrian, but because they don't have any dramatic existence independent of the stories they're recreating. There's nothing older than yesterday's docudrama. Who'd go now to rent any of the docudramas that were made about the Amy Fisher case or the Menendez brothers? Not to mention Everybody's Baby, the rescue of Jessica McClure. That was the Jessica who was rescued from the drainpipe in Texas, not the one who was rescued from an Iraqi hospital. But for just those reasons, we expect docudramas to be truer than other movies drawn from history. Dramatizing the Reagan presidency or the build-up to 9/11 is not at all the same thing as fictionalizing it, after all. So we accept the things that people do and say in docudramas with the same implicit trust with which we accept the bus routes in a New Yorker short story. We assume that everything is as it actually was, only a bit tidier. And when screenwriters misrepresent the events themselves, then the production needs something more than the standard disclaimer about being a dramatization. Notice, they should say, the program you are about to see is not a docudrama, it's just a bad movie.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. His new book on political language is called Talking Right. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by Joe Glazer, a singer-songwriter known for his labor songs. He died Tuesday of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. He was 88. This song comes from his 1960 album, Songs of Work and Freedom.
I went down, down, down to the factory early on a Monday morning. When I got down to the factory, it was lonely, it was forlorn. I couldn't find Joe, Jack, John, or Jim, nobody could I see. Nothing but buttons and bells and lights all over the factory. Well, I walked into the foreman's office to find out what was what. I looked him in the eye and I said, what goes? This is the answer I got. His eyes turned red, then green and blue, and it suddenly dawned on me. There was a robot sitting in the seat where the foreman used to be.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, sponsoring the Retirement Security Project and a Savers Society to help Americans build secure futures at pewtrusts.org. And from the Annenberg Fund for Excellence in Communications and Education. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor James Woods. He played a sociopathic killer in The Onion Field, a gangster in Once Upon a Time in America, and a pimp in Casino. Now he's starring in the new CBS drama Shark as the ruthless superstar lawyer Sebastian Stark. Join us for the next Fresh Air.